article column here. It's Commonwealth of Virginia and James McKinley Taylor. James McKinley Taylor. We have Mr. Forstie.
Yes, Your Honor.
And Ms. Dunn for real?
Yes.
Yeah. Take advantage of him because he's at a disadvantage. Would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal, sir?
Yes. Well, 1 minute.
1 minute? All right. You have it. You may begin when ready, sir.
Counsel, correct me if I'm wrong. The drugs that he was convicted of was limited to them in the kitchen, right?
That is correct, Judge.
Not in the bedrooms.
That is correct, Judge.
Okay.
May please the court. My name is Aaron Forstie and I represent James McKinley Taylor. I believe this case presents two potential issues. The first is whether or not the evidence was sufficient to show that Mr. Taylor constructively possessed the narcotics that were found in the kitchen. And second, slightly related, is whether or not the trial court rendered inconsistent verdicts in finding Mr. Taylor not guilty as to the possession of the firearms or not guilty in possession of a firearm by a convicted felon in possession of a firearm while in possession of a controlled substance.
There were no guns found in the kitchen.
That is correct, Your Honor. There were only guns found in the bedroom, two of the bedrooms, I believe. As to the first issue, it is a question of sufficiency, so the court will review the record in a light most favorable to the Commonwealth and will only reverse if the trial court was plainly wrong or there's no evidence to support the trial court's finding of Mr. Taylor guilty of constructive possession. Since it's a constructive possession case, the court looks to the statements, conduct, and acts of Mr. Taylor. As a starting point, the mere presence of Mr. Taylor in the house when the search warrant was executed is not enough. And just to give the court a little background, the search warrant was executed early morning in November. When the warrant was executed, there were multiple individuals in the home. The police first encountered Mr. Taylor in a hallway. After they encountered him, they led him to the living room. He was completely cooperative. They searched his person. They didn't return any narcotics or any incidents of drug distribution on or about his person. He made no evidence that he made any statements that he had any knowledge of the narcotics. And then while conducting their search in one of the bedrooms, they found two handguns, I believe some crack cocaine, as well as a number of baggies and pants that contained a number of baggies.
We're not talking about what was found in the bedrooms, right?
That is correct, Your Honor. I guess as to the kitchen, what was found in the kitchen was a large bundle of cocaine, as well as two financial documents, both with Mr. Taylor's name on it. One would be a wage earning statements from approximately 2 months prior, and the other was a letter from the Division of Child Support sent a few weeks prior and addressed to a different address. From that standpoint, I would say that the evidence as to his knowledge or his dominion and control as to the substance is merely the fact that he was present at the time. And
the trial court actually, though, took it a step further, and I'm reading specifically from the transcript. Trial court says there's no question that this was a drug dealing operation occurring at this residence or at this address, I think is what the trial court said. And so I think what I read from that, and correct me if you think my analytical framework is wrong, is that the trial court was essentially coming to the view that there were drugs being dealt all over that place, and there was a significant connection between what was specifically found in the kitchen with the defendant having some connection to those items found in the kitchen, that there was enough to suggest to this finder of fact that there was drug dealing going on throughout the entire residence, maybe more drug dealing in other areas of the house, but as far as it was concerned, there was enough to show that this was an operation that was being conducted throughout the entire house. What would be your response to that?
Your Honor, my response to that would be there were multiple individuals at the home at the time of the offense, and I believe one of the other individuals' rooms contained narcotics and incidents of distribution.
And theoretically, that person could have been charged and convicted of that.
That is correct, Your Honor. I would submit the evidence was sufficient to show that there was some sort of distribution operation from that residence. I believe the question becomes whether or not Mr. Taylor had knowledge of the presence of the substances, and I would submit
that. About his personal papers, there were no other occupants of the house had personal papers in the kitchen, did they?
I believe that is correct, Your Honor. But just the very nature of a kitchen, it's a communal area where people come in and out. And he was, when the police entered into the home, he wasn't found in the kitchen. He was found in the hallway, which is separated by walls from the kitchen. And as I said, as the police approached him, he was cooperative, and there's no indication he was anything but cooperative.
This case is constructive in nature, and so therefore there has to be determination that the defendant was exercising dominion and control over the substances that were found. And typically, don't we determine that that is a fact call, as long as there are circumstances to suggest that the individual had dominion and control over the substance, that traditionally or typically is enough to withstand a conviction?
I agree, Your Honor, but I believe there are certain cases out there that I outlined in my brief that would indicate that the circumstances in this case, the presence of the financial documents coupled with the presence of Mr. Taylor in the home, isn't enough. I believe the Corden case, which is a case where the appellant wasn't in the room when the drugs were found, but he had said it was his room. In the room, there were checks and other documents found to him. Ultimately, the court found that that was insufficient. I'd also rely on the Boley case, which...
It's the standard or the analysis that is used in these kinds of cases, again, is finding that the person was both aware of and demonstrated dominion and control over the substance. Is your perspective going at the aware of or demonstrated dominion and control over prong of the test?
I would say my argument is that he wasn't aware of the drugs.
Okay, I was hoping you wouldn't say that, because then we have a problem, because if your pay stub and personal effects are caught up in the midst of the drugs, doesn't that suggest awareness of it? Because usually people don't put their pay stubs amongst drugs.
Your Honor, and I would just go back to the fact that the pay stub was dated 2 months prior, and
isn't some of his child support information also right there?
And once again, that was dated, I believe, 2 weeks prior and sent to a different address. So
that might be even more probative, because that means he brought it over to this address.
But there was no evidence introduced as to when any of those documents came to be located.
Might your better argument be that there wasn't a demonstration of dominion and control over the substance because there's no nexus other than his personal effects being amongst the things, but we don't have the traditional factors that we would find for dominion and control? Would that be a better argument?
I would agree that would also be a strong argument in this case, given the fact that he wasn't found in the same room that the drugs were found.
Okay.
And then turning to the second issue, a potential prior inconsistent verdicts, I would argue under Akers, the Court of Appeals indicated that prior inconsistent verdicts are not acceptable from a court. Obviously, that was a case that had to deal with malicious wounding and use of a firearm in the commission of a malicious wounding.
But here, the guns were found in the bedroom, not in the kitchen. So how can it be an inconsistent verdict when the facts are different? In other words, inconsistent verdict is given the same facts, trial court goes in two different directions.
I would argue...
Is that a fair analysis of inconsistent verdict?
That is a fair analysis. I would argue that the facts seem to be extremely similar to both situations. I believe there was testimony from one of the officers that at least one letter addressed to Mr. Taylor was found in the bedroom. Additionally, pants that were given... There was a pair of pants that were given to Taylor that he put on, and I would I would argue that the only difference evidentiary from the bedroom and the kitchen was the presence of the two firearms. I would say the evidence.
There's a case from a sister jurisdiction, Johnson versus State, where Maryland Court of Appeals held that an inconsistent verdict would be sustained where the trial court on the record explains an apparent inconsistency in the verdict, and where the explanation shows that the trial court's action was proper and there was no unfairness. What would be wrong with us adopting that standard?
I don't believe there would be anything wrong with the court adopting that standard. I believe there's a Virginia Court of Appeals case.
Acres. Similar.
One that was interpreting Acres after the fact, where it was involving a DUI and a habitual offender, and the court found the defendant not guilty of the DUI on the basic basis of leniency. I think the court actually made the statement that I'm finding not guilty of the DUI out of leniency. I would just submit to this court that I don't think there's a sufficient explanation from the trial court judges to the reason for the deviation in this case.
Well, if there's no inconsistent verdict, then he doesn't have to explain why.
I would agree if there was no inconsistent verdict, there would be no reason, rationale for him. Need a rationale, and I would just reserve the rest of my time.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Now let's go ahead and maybe work in reverse here. Do you think that this court should adopt the standard that was cites Acres out of Johnson versus State, where we say that there's no inconsistency because there's an explanation by the trial court?
Yes. If the trial court explains himself fully, then he's explaining away why there would be an inconsistency.
What facts and circumstances would you point to in the record that show that there was an inconsistency in the factual basis for the adjudication of each case?
In this case, there was no inconsistency at all. Here we have different facts in the bedroom and in the kitchen. Three different officers testified about the presence of male or lack thereof. In the bedroom, Detective Hocut testified that he didn't even find any male. Detective Scott testified that he did find male, however, he did not collect the male. He couldn't remember if he even picked it up. And the photograph of mail in the bedroom or papers in the bedroom never showed anyone's name to it. And then the last officer that testified was Detective Daschle for the papers in the bedroom. And that detective testified that there was an earning statement, but it was never picked up. No photos were ever taken of it. It wasn't collected. And this detective did not know if other officers had moved papers around in the bedroom itself. You compare that to the facts about the pay stub and the child support services letter in the kitchen. Detective Hocut testified that the sandwich baggie box contained a pay stub. Detective Morris testified that the pay stub was in the sandwich baggie box as well, and Detective Daschle took photographs of the box with the pay stub in it and testified that there was mail on top of the refrigerator, and also testified and took pictures of the letter, the child support services letter, that was underneath the box on top of the refrigerator. So there's ample evidence, including photographs, that show Taylor's name on these very personal papers in the kitchen, but in the bedroom, we don't really know what was going on. And that's what the judge, how he explained his reasoning. He said there's a direct nexus that we're completely tied to the stuff in the kitchen, but it's not sufficient. The evidence isn't strong enough because it's conflicting with regards to the papers in the bedroom. So those are the factual differences.
I mean, there are pants in the bedroom, and the pants fit him. And it's the only bedroom in the house that isn't occupied if he's not occupying it, right?
Yes, that's true. And I think it was pointed out at trial that the size of the pants was never written down, and no one else in the household tried on the pants. It was just the one, this Taylor.
Put on some pants here.
Yeah, cover yourself up. Yes, Your Honor. the evidence at trial was sufficient to convict Taylor of constructively possessing the cocaine in the kitchen, and there's ample evidence to support the trial judge's conviction. First, the house was riddled with drugs and paraphernalia. Room 5, which was a bedroom, contained guns, 2 digital scales, a bag of crack cocaine, and numerous cut baggies. The kitchen contained 3 bags of crack cocaine, 2 digital scales, one of which I know had at least residue of cocaine on it, loose money, marijuana, cut baggies, and approximately...
None of that could be attributable to any of the people in the house other than his personal papers.
Right? Sorry, can you please repeat yourself?
Sorry. Everything that you're arguing could be attributable to everybody in the house other than his personal papers on the refrigerator.
Yes, it could be attributable to other people in the house, and constructive possession can be joint. Yes. Let's see. Additionally, the police executed the search at 4:38 in the morning, and they came across Taylor in the middle of the hallway in a state of undress. So it can be inferred that he was at least spending the night that night in the house, which also goes to his awareness of what was going on in this house being a drug dealing center. The relationship of the occupants in the house is also relevant. This isn't a situation in which we're at a party and there's a bunch of acquaintances, people don't know each other. Here, everyone's intimately related. It's a mother and her 2 grown children. So that's another relevant factor. And finally, there is this nexus in the kitchen with the pay stub and the child support services letter. The pay stub itself was found in a baggie box, which also contained money. And those baggies were used to package cocaine. That was their purpose. Additionally, these documents were very, very personal. These are types of documents that you want to keep track of, and you want them to be accessible to yourself. So it's a reasonable inference that the Taylor was using the top of the refrigerator kind of as a cubby to put his personal effects. So when you look at all of this evidence, it's clear that the trial court was not plainly wrong, and there is a lot of evidence to support this conviction. If there's no further questions, I ask that the court affirm.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
Sir, if you'd like, and it's no disrespect to the court, if you'd be more comfortable sitting down, that's fine.
That's okay, Your Honor.
We're pretty decent guys.
I would just, as to the inconsistent verdicts, I would once again point to the bedroom and the fact that there were pants that fit Mr. Taylor, given to Mr. Taylor, he put them on. And as for the constructive possession of the drugs found in the kitchen, I would just once again reiterate that the totality of the evidence would be his presence and the fact that those 2 documents were there. And we would just ask that you reverse and dismiss his conviction.
All right. Thank you, sir. We'll come down and greet counsel. We're going to take a very short recess until